I want to, tonight, go back to some things that we talked, well, at least go back to a text that we started with this morning. This morning we talked about the beginning of the divided kingdom. Specifically, we approached this time period from the perspective of how it exactly started, what went wrong, who made what mistakes, where. And we actually talked about Rehoboam. We dealt with 1 Kings 12. What I want to do tonight is I want to go back to 1 Kings 12. This morning we kind of dealt with the front end of it. I want to deal with the back end tonight, but I want to do something more than just looking at 1 Kings 12 from verse 25 to the end of the chapter. I mean, I've done that before here, and it was within the last year and a couple months, and I don't want to repeat myself too frequently. I don't mind repeating myself. You guys know that by now, right? I don't want to repeat myself too frequently, though, but I do want to take a little bit of a look at it as sort of a starting off point to sort of keep in mind some of the things that happened. But I also want to look at another man, at another person, another thing, era in biblical history. But just to sort of get into where we want to go, let's go ahead and read 1 Kings 12 from chapter 12, verse 25, to the end of the chapter, as a matter of fact, 25 to 33. Then Jeroboam built Shechem and in the hill country of Ephraim, and he lived there. And he went out from there, and he built Penuel. Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And then they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So the king took counsel, and he made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold, your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Dan, or in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. This thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. And he also made temples on high places, and he appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. And he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. And he went up to the altar that he made in Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel. And he went up to the altar to make offerings. It's pretty easy for us to look at this text and say it's talking about, it's recording history first and foremost, but he's talking about idolatry, right? The idolatry that Jeroboam instituted. As a matter of fact, if you read through every single account of every single king that the northern kingdom of Israel ever had, on the list of all the things that the king did that was wrong, there's always that, and he continued in the ways of Jeroboam his father and the golden calves that he had made, and he made Israel to sin. As a matter of fact, the best king that Israel had after this was Jehu, son of Nimshi. He was their best. He was sort of the high point. He was the one that did in Ahab, and anyone who does in Ahab is good in my book. But he's the one who finished off Ahab and Jezebel. And it talked about how he destroyed the high places, how he destroyed the altars to Baal and Asherah, how he tore them down and burned them. But the one thing he didn't do, the one thing where he failed to execute the will of God in, was he persisted in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and the golden calves that were at Dan and Bethel. This thing is part of what destroyed this nation ultimately. Their inability to give this up, to surrender this. And so, I mean, I've picked apart this text before and all the things that go wrong, but I want to do it again tonight, but briefly, but I want to do it again so our heads are all in the right place for looking at this. I mean, the first thing that happens is that Jeroboam builds golden calves, right? Now, this is sounding pretty familiar, isn't it? I mean, all we got to do is rewind back to Exodus 32, and we saw that that got somebody in a whole heap of trouble, didn't it? When Israel built that first golden calf on the side of the mountain, on the side of Mount Sinai, when God looked down and he saw it, he was so angry that he's going to wipe everybody out and start over with Moses. And Moses says, no, 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 don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. I know you're mad, but maybe it's not that bad. I'll go down and fix it. And God says, yeah, all right, you will. If you want to intercede for these people, you fix the problem. So Moses goes down, and he's so angry that an 80-year-old man throws tablets of stone on the ground hard enough to shatter them. That's rage. And then his solution is to gather around anyone who will stand for the Lord, which ends up being his own tribe of Levi. And he tells them, you go out throughout the camp, and you just start killing people who are doing this, and you keep killing people until they stop. That's his solution. And it works. Of course, the penalty for idolatry under the law was death. And they had just agreed to a covenant with God in Exodus 24. And so it seems like Jeroboam should have learned from that lesson. And I've talked about the fact before that clever men could deceive themselves into believing that this is actually not idolatry, that they're not actually violating any commandments here. That clever men who look at the cultural context of the world that they lived in and how the bull or the auroch, the animal, the cow, was often a symbol of divine power all throughout the entire Mediterranean world because it was the strongest thing that they knew that could provide both life and take it away in half a second. Egyptian deities were often depicted as standing upon the back of a cow. Because it was such a strong animal, it must have been a gift from the gods, therefore connected to them. And so both Aaron and Jeroboam, by fashioning this golden cow figure, all they're doing is they're giving a symbol of divine power. They're not actually fashioning an image of God himself, right? So we're not really carving an image of God. Clever men could deceive themselves into thinking that that was true and that that was acceptable. However, the commandment is you shall make no graven images of God. It's you shall make no graven images. So there's this obvious problem. There's the unauthorized priest not of the tribe of Levi. There's all the other things that are going wrong. There's the fact that they're in Dan and Bethel, whereas the worship at that time in Israel's history was supposed to be done in Jerusalem. The sacrifices and the incense burning, they were all supposed to happen in Jerusalem. And all these things, we've gone through all these before, right? This is sounding familiar. I've said all these things before. We've talked about them. What I want to do tonight is I want to compare this man with another man. And I want for us to do it in a way that sort of analyzes perhaps what's going on in their brains. And I want for us to then take that and apply it ourselves and ask ourselves some questions about the world that we live in and the people that we interact with. I want for us to ask tonight, which I don't think I dealt with a whole lot last time I talked about this, I want for us to ask, where does this begin? All of these things. Where does the idolatry of Jeroboam really begin? And the answer is actually for us in the text. The answer is found for us in verses 26 and 27. Jeroboam said in his heart, the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam the king of Judah, and they will kill me, and they will return to Rehoboam the king of Judah. All the things that Jeroboam says to the congregation of Israel, that, oh, the trip to Jerusalem is so far. You've done it often enough, whereas they really hadn't barely been doing it at all for only 40 years. compared to their history as a nation, which lasted a few centuries by now. You've done it for long enough. It's just so difficult. It's so hard. This is just so much easier. We can do it here. It'll be okay. All the excuses that he seems that he offers the people to lead them along this pathway. What verses 26 and 27 tell us is that Jeroboam knew they were lies. He knew, flat out, that they were lies. And he's telling the people all the things that he tells them. It's, oh, you've gone up to Jerusalem, and this is just so much easier. We can just do it right here at home, and we don't have to make that long trip, and we don't have to deal with Rehoboam and his priests and all the bad things that they've done to us. He knows hogwash. And he's doing this wholesale, making it out of cloth for his own personal ambition. The scripture records the thoughts of Jeroboam. He is afraid. He is afraid that he's going to lose his power. Now, we could sort of take this and we could go into an analysis of all the things that are wrong with this thought process. Well, God put him on that throne in the first place. If he'd really trusted in God, he wouldn't be afraid of losing his power, right? We could talk about that and we can make those applications, but that's not what I want to do tonight so much. I want for us to notice the calculated nature of Jeroboam's idolatry and how it's deliberate. He is knowingly doing something and leading people in something that is false. And he is completely aware of that. And I don't want us to make any mistakes. I mean, I talked about the fact that a clever man could deceive himself into believing this. But a man who's clever to deceive other people into believing that knows that it's a lie. They know it's a lie. Especially when they make it up in the first place. They know it's not true. And they know full well that what they are doing is a misinterpretation and a misapplication of the text. They know it. And that's a huge problem. That's a massive, massive, massive problem. So I want for us to keep Jeroboam in mind and remember Jeroboam, but I want for us to actually look at somebody else tonight too. This part is going to sound familiar to people who are in Bible class on Sunday morning. It just so happened that we ended up going through that chunk of text this morning when I was planning on talking about it tonight, so you're going to get a double dose. But everybody turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. I find some of the opening verses of this chapter to be particularly rich when describing the character of Solomon and what he's like. Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter, he brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people were sacrificing at the high places, however, because no house had yet been built for the name of the Lord. And what's going on in Israel is kind of interesting. Because, like I said this morning, we often look at David's reign as being the spiritual high point of the nation of Israel, right? That was their spiritual golden age. That was where they were at their best as a nation in their relationship with God. And one of the things that I said this morning in class is I beg to differ. I do. Because David might have been spiritually one of the best kings. But what this verse actually tells us about people sacrificing on the high places and engaging in idolatrous worship, it tells us that even though David was a good leader and even though David's heart was in the right place, yes, he made mistakes, but he was trying to do what was right, the rest of the people weren't following. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. David could be the best example a nation could ever have, and the people, nothing. Because this is what they had known for hundreds of years. And it started back during the days of the conquest. And it continued and it snowballed and it created problem after problem after problem during the days of the judges. Yet they didn't realize what the real problem was and they kept on doing it anyway. And they kept on doing it anyway to the point where they began to look, act, and behave exactly like a Gentile nation. And they asked Samuel, give us a king like the nations around us. And that's exactly what they got in Saul. And then God gives them David, teaching them and showing them that there's a better way. But they turn a deaf ear to that. And so for the 40 years of David's reign, all the times he's trying to do what's right, all the times he's trying to show the people what's right, they continue on with their idolatry over and over again. Here's where we're going to pick back up with 1 Kings 3, though. Verse 3. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father. So he did what was right, right? Did a good job. He loved the Lord. He did what his father told him to do. He followed his father's example of righteousness and justice and holiness. But what does the rest of the verse say? Only. Or except there's something he did wrong. He sacrificed and made offerings in the high place. So here's the picture that I get. You've got the nation of Israel offering sacrifices to Baal and to Asherah and to Molech. And pick your Amorite deity, right? And you have Israelites making offerings because that's what we know they did. Because that's what they did all throughout the time of the judges. That's what they did in the time of Saul. And then that's what they're doing after David and Solomon. And that's what they're doing during David and Solomon. And so you have the nation at large just throwing themselves headlong into idolatry. And you have Solomon, who loves God very seriously and very devoutly, loves God. But here he is offering sacrifices on high places like a pagan. Now the difference is that Solomon is offering these sacrifices to Yahweh, whereas most of the rest of the Israelites are offering these sacrifices to Baal or to Molech. But here's Solomon offering these sacrifices to Yahweh, but he's doing it like a pagan. I find that very interesting. But it's also very telling. What I want to do now is I want for us to compare these men. I want for us to take a step back and to look at them sort of side by side. Because make no mistake, Solomon's practices in verse 3, they're idolatrous. They are idolatrous. He's offering an idolatrous sacrifice to Yahweh. How can that be? He's doing it in a way that was forbidden. He's doing it in a way that was not prescribed. He's doing it in a way that was unauthorized. And that makes it idolatrous. But the difference between these men is that Jeroboam knew full well exactly what he was doing at the time. He knew going into it that this is not what God wanted. Whereas I get the feeling that Solomon might not have. I get this feeling that Solomon might have been acting out of ignorance. And we explored this concept a little bit in our Bible class this morning. And so for those of you who are there, forgive me. I'm going to be repeating what we said. But for those of you who weren't there, this is actually kind of important. And it's a very interesting thing to look at. What we have is we have a holy, righteous, devout man. At least he tries to be righteous in his heart, right? But we have him engaging in completely unauthorized, idolatrous practices. And how is it that can be? And the answer, I think, is very, very, very simple. Solomon became infected by his culture. That's, I think, a very simple answer. He became infected by the culture that he lived in. He grew up in this culture in which worship was done on these high places. And so he goes to this high place and he offers a sacrifice to the God that he knows is the real God, but he does it in a way in which it makes him look just like everybody else. And he begins to reflect the culture of the world around him instead of reflecting the culture of the God who made him. And that's the difference. One goes into this knowingly, with his eyes open, knowing that it's wrong, or at least knowing that it's not what God demanded and commanded as far as his worship is concerned. The other one is completely and utterly oblivious of that. And for what I want for us to do is I want for us to actually take a step back now and look at that and consider the implications for that in our lives. Because, I mean, here's the most direct application that a lot of us probably see, a lot of us probably go to, is we go to our friends and the rest of, quote-unquote, and I use this term loosely, and I hope you understand it for the way I mean it, quote-unquote, Christendom, right? The rest of the quote-unquote Christian world. What I mean when I say that is but the rest of the people who define themselves as Christians. The rest of the people who think that they're Christians. I am convinced, just by some of the things that I've seen and the things that I've heard from people that come out of their mouths that are so crazy and insane and so far from the truth, that I'm convinced they know it's a lie. And that they're using it to get themselves wealth and power and whatever they want. I'm convinced that that's the way some people are. I'm sorry. I've seen too much. I've heard too much in the name of God that is totally bogus and nonsense to believe any otherwise. There are some people who know that they're snake oil salesmen. They just know it. And they have no problem exploiting that for their own ends. And that's the way some people are going to be. And that's never going to change. So Jeroboam was exactly that way 3,000 years ago, and he knew it, and he didn't care what other people thought of it. He just threw himself into it because he wasn't concerned about what was right. He was concerned with his own wealth, with his own power, with his own glory, and his own stability. I could mention some names. I won't. But I just want you guys to think of the prosperity gospel preachers. Oh, if you give me, if you plant a seed, an economic seed, in my pocket, I promise you, God will make that seed grow in your pocket. I promise you. I know he's going to do it. There's an expose on this. But one guy from a nightly TV show, and his language is not the cleanest, right? But he actually sent money to these people just to find out what would happen. And he came back to his audience. He's a British guy named John Oliver. And if you choose to watch a YouTube clip of his show, of this, feel free. I warn you, there are some language issues, but it's brilliant. Because he follows it all the way through to the point where he had now given these people, under the guise of investigating journalistically what's really going on, hundreds of dollars. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Nothing in return. And the kind of gimmicks that they have and the things that they do are absolutely insane. And I'm convinced. I don't understand how anybody could be doing this innocently. I don't. If there are some, I apologize to them. I just don't understand it. And we see so much hypocrisy in the religious world. Knowing hypocrisy. And I could get into story and story after story after story of this religious group or that religious group or these people or those people or the things that they've done and the things that those other ones have done. But if I did that, I'd run a poll and we'd be here till midnight. So you guys know what I'm talking about, right? But then there's the other group of people. The other group of people who actually think they're doing what's right and who really believe they're doing what's right. And are convinced that they're serving God righteously. And it's these people that my heart goes out to. It's these people that I want to talk to. And I had an occasion, the reason this has been on my mind and I wanted to talk about it tonight is that I had an occasion Tuesday. I was here at the building. And I got a phone call. And I answered at Eastwood Hill Church Christ, building phone. Is this Pastor Aaron? I don't bother correcting that on first conversation anymore. I don't. It's a discussion that takes too long, that it's just not worth it right now. If we have more than one discussion, then we can talk about that, right? But I just said, speaking, yeah, okay. What he means when he says pastor is different from what I mean when I say pastor. So I'll accept what he means when he says pastor. Okay, yeah, I am. He says, are you in the building? Yeah, I'm in the building. Oh, okay, I didn't think anybody was home. I said, well, my car's parked way out back in the shade, so it's not easily visible from the street. He said, okay, well, can I come in and talk to you about some things real quick? I'm like, yeah, sure, okay. Let me go open the door, open the gate for you. I mean, the gate was unlocked. It usually is when I'm here. I just close it sometimes, but it's unlocked. And so I opened the door. He came in the building, and he was offering financial services for the church, like investment stuff. And I said, well, we're nonprofit, you know. Investing for a profit is kind of not nonprofit. It's the way it is. And the biblical paradigm that we see for generation of revenue for a congregation is members contribute of their own free will. That's the biblical paradigm we have. So that's how we generally choose to follow. But, I mean, I'm happy to sit and listen to your deal, and I can forward the information on to the people that I answer to. And he says, yeah, the elders, obviously. I mean, that would be what you do. So I'm like, okay. And he was offering these. The group that he works for offers these services to restoration movement churches, quote unquote. And he actually knew what that meant, right? Because he's a part of that world. So he means churches of Christ, Christian churches, and disciples of Christ. And we had a conversation about this. And he even actually knew the difference between non-institutional churches of Christ and institutional churches of Christ, which I actually found kind of interesting, the fact that he understood the difference, where there's not a whole lot of people that do. And he worships at a First Christian Church somewhere out of California. So we had a lot of great conversation about what he does and you know, the services that they offer. And I explained how our elders tend to like to do business, but I'll forward the information on to them, you know, whatever. They can look at it, right? It's their decision to make, not mine. But then he asked me this question. He asked me, he said, I've always wanted to understand from the words of you guys, and what he meant was churches of Christ, particularly more conservative ones, whether institutional or non-institutional, the more conservative ones. And he said, I always wanted to understand why you don't have instruments in your worship service. And I don't know if you guys are aware, but the Christian churches come from our heritage within America. Around the early 1900s, Churches of Christ had a split over instrumental music. The Christian churches went one way, we went another. You can guess which direction they went, since they're the direction we didn't go. And so they have instrumental music. And I said, well, I'll tell you why. So I got out Ephesians 5:19, right? And I have a couple of my Greek textbooks back there in my library, so I even walked him through a basic rudimentary analysis of the language, that phrase, making melody in your heart to the Lord, or with your heart to the Lord. I even walked him through a breakdown of that grammatically. So you see, I'm not pulling this out of nowhere, okay? This comes from something, and it's important to me. And then we went to Leviticus 10, and we went to of all places, 1 Kings 12. And we talked about the important nature of authority. We went to Hebrews 7:14. It is evident that our Lord is descended from Judah, and regarding that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests, thus banning priests from anyone other than the place where he authorized them to be from. So we had actually a lot of really great discussion about that, and it lasted about an hour or an hour and a half, and it was actually really long. And I could tell he was actually, I could tell he was being hit by some of the things I said very viscerally, that it was affecting him, which is good. It's very good. Because what that means, and I say this to compliment him, it means that his zeal is a real thing. That his desire to please God is honest. It means that what he really wants is to do the right thing. And he sort of stopped sort of at the end and he said, I just want you to get something straight. Are you saying that me and my wife, who is, by the way, a worship leader at our church, and I didn't really get into that a whole lot, but are you saying that we're going to hell? And I said, no, I'm not saying you're going to hell. What I'm saying is this is my understanding of what the Bible says. That's all I said. And the words are coming from here, not from within me. So it's not me saying it. I mean, I had my iPad active, and we were reading through the scriptures on my iPad, right? That's how we were doing high-tech universe, right? So he was reading everything along with me. And then he said something to me that kind of hit me profoundly and made me think. He said, so you're saying that my whole life has been a waste. That all the things that we've tried to do, that the love that we have for God and our desire to prove him, they're all just a waste. We've been wasting our time. And it's all been useless. That actually stopped me and made me think for a second. It really did. And what I ended up saying to him, something that I stand by, I said, no. None of your life has been a waste. Not a single second of it, because what that has done, what your background has done, is it's instilled in you a zeal for God and a desire to please him and a desire to do things according to his will, because what I've said has obviously hit you in some way, shape, or form that causes you to respond this way. And I said, what I would advise you to do is take that love that you have for God, that zeal that you have for him, the same zeal that Solomon had, and distill it and make it pure, and then inform it with the scriptures. Because they're never going to lead you in the wrong way. And my whole point in looking at these 2 men and telling these stories and bringing up our experiences in the world is for us to stop and to think about how our friends from the quote-unquote restoration movement that history calls the Stone Campbell movement, who have gone down the path of instrumental music, how they have allowed the culture of the religious world of America to infect it. That's what's happened. And I'll give most of them credit that it's happened in ignorance. That it's happened in I don't want to say innocence, but you guys get what I mean, because it doesn't excuse what they're doing as being unauthorized. It's still unauthorized. I've done sermons about that. I'm not going to change my position on that now, because that's very clearly what I believe the position of the scriptures to be. But I think a lot of it's done out of ignorance. And where I'm going with this tonight is introspection. I want for us now to look at ourselves. To take a long, hard, honest look at me. Because that's really what we do when we look at the Bible, right? One of the most important verses, I think, in the Bible is found in the book of James. Chapter 1. And I'm going to start reading in verse 22. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he sees himself and then he goes away, and at once he forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer he acts, he will be blessed in his doing. the purpose, the reason I get up here and I preach these sermons and we study the Bible in Bible class on Sunday morning and on Wednesday night isn't so we can get up and we can deliver lessons about how good we are and how good we feel about all the right things that we're doing and how everybody else has it wrong. That's not why I'm doing it. And if that's our impression, then we need some serious adjustment. The reason we do this is to look at ourselves, to take a long, hard look in that mirror. Because the truth is, our friends in the Christian churches and the disciples of Christ, that could easily be us. Quite easily be us. No one is immune to that. The devil doesn't come to us wearing horns and a red cape. He comes to us with a smile and an open hand. And he leads us with friendliness down the path of destruction. When we will sin out of ignorance, thinking that we're pleasing God. Which makes it all the more important not to be Jeroboam, not to be Solomon, but to be Josiah, who found the book of the law, who read it, and who wept when he saw that what he was doing was wrong. It's to be David, the man who wrote, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path," to make sure that whatever we do, whether it's our congregational worship or the choices we make every single day, every single thing that we do are guided by one source and one source alone. As Jesus said, "Have you not read?" Because that's who we are, and that's who we ought to be. If you'd like to give yourself to Christ, to make your covenant with Him, and to dedicate your life to His guidance through His Word tonight, we'd encourage you to do so. If you'd like to do that, or if there's any other prayer we can offer on your behalf, please come forward and let us know what it is as we stand and sing song number 332.